WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. Last week, officials of the Taliban, the ruling government of Afghanistan, issued a decree to demolish all pre-Islamic statues that represent the human form. The Taliban reportedly began destroying ancient sacred art last Friday. Among their targets were two immense statues of Buddha carved into the side of a sandstone cliff some 1,400 years ago in Bamyan. Protest has rained down on the Taliban in the past week from all sides, including from other Islamic nations. I spoke yesterday with Thomas Gutierrez about the complicated political situation in Afghanistan. Gutierrez is the director of the Center for Afghanistan Studies at the University of Nebraska in Omaha. He lived in Afghanistan from 1964 to 1974 and has been back many times to do research for his center and for the United Nations. He's visited the Buddhist statues at Bamyan many times.
Well, actually, I've always considered two places my favorite places in the whole world. One, Tiger Stadium, my favorite baseball team used to play there, in Bamyan in Afghanistan. And in Bamyan in Afghanistan, this is an incredibly beautiful, pristine valley at around 9,000 feet. And here was a fertile valley with a stream running through the whole expanse of it. And on either side, major bluffs that were really eroded into cliffs. And into the cliffs on the northern side of the valley were carved these Buddhas. I used to love to sit on the bluffs above, on the southern side of the valley, and just look across this incredible valley where people are working down below, farming, harvesting, running through the town, and maybe about 4 or 5 football fields length away from where I was sitting was where these Buddhas were located. So there was this incredibly, beautiful work of art in these across the way. And then there was man down below, living and working and going about his lifestyle, much in the same way that man was going about working and his lifestyle during the period when these Buddhas were constructed. In the face of this cliff, flanked, which these two Buddhas, these very large statues, were flanking, were a series people have described as some 5 kilometers of caves that were very ornate, very deeply carved into the sandstone cliffs, that were kind of gathering halls, eating halls, dormitories for the Buddhist monks and others who would be staying at this particular religious site or a monastery, perhaps. But for me, it was always my favorite place because I had spent 10 years in Afghanistan, and it was a spot of uncommon calm and charm and beauty.
I believe this site has already been compromised by war. Resistance guerrilla fighters have been headquartered in these caves in Bamyan, and there is a rumor that the statues themselves were used at one point for target practice.
Well, I've heard that too, but I can tell you that I was there as late as 1999, and none of that had occurred. And I was very pleased to see that because there had been a lot of fighting in that valley, and it was, of great concern because these really are Afghanistan's greatest treasure. These are the things that people would travel, thousands of miles from around the other side of the world to come to visit because they are so spectacular. They were layered with terracotta, which was, at least 15 centuries old, and they were also within the niche in which they were carved. There were terracotta types of frescoes, and the colors of which were still there because it, unlike the Sistine Chapel, they hadn't had any reconstructive painting or anything. And it was just remarkable that all of this was there yet to see.
Mullah Muhammad Omar, the Taliban supreme leader, is the main thrust behind the campaign against the statues. What is his justification for the destruction of the art?
Well, of course, there can be no real justification, but his justification, as he believes it is that all forms of humans should not should be destroyed, because that it's improper for Muslims to represent the human form. And this comes out of a decision that the Prophet Muhammad and his followers observed after the beginnings of Islam, in which idols of a of the kind of one would call them the animistic religions around Mecca and Medina were destroyed by them. But they did never declare or suggest that works of art or things of that nature should be included in that particular type of thing. And through the centuries, Muslims have always exhibited a level of tolerance in terms of preserving the art forms of other cultures over which they may have gained sway. And it is, very hard to understand from whence Mullah Omar gains his extreme interpretation.
In news reports, a number of Taliban officials have expressed dismay and disagreement with the mullah's decree to destroy the statuary. How strong is his support even among the Taliban rank and file?
Well, his support, particularly when he came into power in the mid-90s, was quite high, because Afghanistan had just gone through a period of nearly 20 years of war. Now it's a period that goes beyond 20 years. When you consider the coup that brought in the pro-Soviet government, and then the Soviet invasion, and then the Soviet-Afghan war, which ended in 1989. And then thereafter, the kind of civil war that was going on in Afghanistan after the fall of the pro-Soviet government, the Mujahideen, who had been waging war to against the Soviet Union, fell amongst themselves to fighting in a kind of warlord situations. And Mullah Omar kind of rose up as a vigilante character, almost a Robin Hood character, in the Kandahar area in defense of the rights of individuals who were having their rights violated by this very unfortunate anarchic period which was going on in Afghanistan.
So he was seen as a savior?
As a kind of savior initially. And I think one of the reasons why the Taliban were so successful moving from community to community to gain, the support of individuals without having even to fight was that people were so tired of the war, so tired of the corruption, so tired of the rape and the pillaging that was going on between the rival groups, the rival warlords, that they saw this Taliban movement, which kind of sprang up from almost nowhere, as a source of, emancipation. And what, most people are not aware of is that this group started out kind of small, but then it grew very rapidly, and it grew rapidly with the support of the Pakistanis, particularly the Pakistani military. And I think what's happened is that since this time, Mullah Omar and his compatriots have been unable to deliver the kinds of things that almost any citizen would expect of a nation state in terms of social services, public works, and generally a style of life in which they are not daily intimidated by some religious whim or another. And so his popularity now, I think, is at an all-time low within the country. But he still has a very substantial Praetorian guard of Pakistanis, Osama bin Laden, and others who are with him, that helps to keep him in power.
There is speculation that the push to destroy Afghanistan's pre-Islamic heritage is in reaction to the United Nations sanctions imposed on Afghanistan in January for not surrendering the Saudi militant leader Osama bin Laden. What do you make of that theory?
I don't agree with it. This is an idea that has been advanced by the Pakistanis first, and it hasn't yet come out from either the Taliban or other Afghans. I think that it helps to serve, again, the basic foreign policy objective that the Pakistanis have in Afghanistan. So they can blame these kinds of actions as a reaction against, some type of Western actions. And in fact, what we have here is a situation which the Pakistanis themselves are responsible for. In other words, they are, in many ways, the creation of this particular type of what has become a monster, in a sense, in terms of what the people of Afghanistan need. And Mullah Omar has, I think, become kind of obsessed with his own particular belief in him, of him possessing some type of divine right or line, direct line of communication with God. And I think with that obsession, he has started to lash out and do these kinds of things.
I'm speaking with Thomas Gutierre. He's the Dean of International Studies and Programs at the University of Nebraska at Omaha and Director of the Center for Afghanistan Studies there. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Thomas Gutierre. He was in the Peace Corps in Afghanistan in the mid-60s and 70s, also headed the Fulbright Foundation there. Now he directs the Center for Afghanistan Studies at the University of Nebraska at Omaha. I'd like you to talk about the role of the United States in Afghanistan. I think the United States funneled arms, billions of dollars of arms and training for soldiers during the war against the Soviets. And critics of U.S. foreign policy in Afghanistan argue that after the Soviets pulled out of the nation, the U.S. basically dropped out, also leaving the country armed to the teeth, full of landmines, CIA-trained terrorists, and a civilian population devastated by the war and by famine, and that policy helped lead to the ascent of the Taliban.
Well, I'm one of those critics. I think that the United States really has a moral obligation to help the Afghan people. They did fight what many consider to be the last battle of the Cold War. They encountered tremendous suffering. Many, many, many Afghans were killed. The estimates usually, focus around about 1.5 million people killed, but some estimates are even higher. And then there were other untold millions who spent their lives living as refugees in either Iran or Pakistan or in other countries. And after the fall of the Soviet Union and subsequently the collapse of the pro-Soviet government in Afghanistan, the United States really did not assume the type of profile that was needed to encourage the more moderate traditional elements within Afghanistan as it needed to embark on its reconstruction. I think in a situation like this where you needed a Marshall Plan style of reconstruction, Afghanistan today looks like Dresden after the Second World War. In a situation like that, the United States kind of dropped back. It didn't come forward. And so all of the traditional, moderate, and historically rich elements of Afghanistan upon which a reconstruction should have been built or based had no real allies. And the more extremist Islamist forms within Afghanistan, groups within Afghanistan, had the support within this vacuum of the extremist elements in Pakistan and the Persian Gulf. And that's what has proceeded from our kind of exit of the area.
You lived in Afghanistan from 64 to 74. Where you worked, first you worked in the Peace Corps, later you worked for the Fulbright Foundation. What was it like living there then?
Well, here I was, a young fellow from Maumee, Ohio, who had never flown in an airplane or seen any foreign country until I flew to Afghanistan. So I can tell you that the first day or two was quite a dramatic change from anything that I had ever seen. And I found an exceedingly hospitable people, very proud people, and a country so rich in history. People like, Alexander the Great, Genghis Khan, Tamerlane, the Mughals, all of these famous waves of humanity that swept through Asia, you know, all went through Afghanistan, leaving incredible riches in art and traditions and history and great food and a place that one kind of would dream of visiting, you know. And understand that the Afghans were not a rich people. The king of Afghanistan, you know, did not live high off the hog, and neither did any other of the other really major elites compared to the way we live in the West or in Europe or whatever. But they had a rich life. In fact, I took Bill Bradley when he was still an NBA basketball player after he and the Knicks won the championship in 1970. I took him to Bamiyan. And because he wanted to visit Afghanistan and a part of Afghanistan that reflected his favorite story of all time, the man who would be king. Like, I used to coach the Afghan national basketball team, and I also coached the Afghan women's basketball team. And I would get invited, you know, into people's homes to have tea. And so there was a really, I think, wonderful social ambiance in the urban settings. In the rural areas, life went on essentially as it had, but there was an egalitarianism in Afghan society which now is missing under the Taliban.
How did basketball come to be such a big sport in Afghanistan?
Well, I'll tell you, I don't know, but it really was a break for me. I was never a great basketball player, but I loved coaching basketball, and I had done some of that in the United States before I went as a Peace Corps volunteer. And while I was teaching it as a Peace Corps volunteer, teaching English, as many of us did, a group of students came up my second day in country, actually, and said, "Now, we understand you coach basketball." Where they heard that, I don't know. "We need a coach for our team, and please help us out." So I started to coach the team Habibia Lycée, where I was an English teacher, and my teams did very well. As a result, I was asked then to coach the Afghan national basketball team, which I did for the next 10 years. And the Afghans were great athletes. They are great athletes. They're tremendous, you know, their capacity to run at a high altitude is fantastic, because we were living at 6,000 feet. And they could, you know, learn the jump shot. I even had Bill Bradley teaching them a jump shot when he came to Afghanistan in 1970. Also, you know, how to do the moving hook, and so it was a fantastic opportunity for me to get to meet a lot of young people, to learn things about Afghanistan's culture, to learn a vocabulary that I might not have learned otherwise, and it was you know, I think the competitive spirit of the Afghans was ensured the success of a basketball program. And friends of mine in the Peace Corps and I, we set up leagues in Kabul. We did a similar thing in Herat and in Kandahar by going and setting up clinics. And basketball started to become the most popular kind of sport in Afghanistan, not the most played. Soccer would be that, of course. But it had high attendance because it was the type of thing that everybody could watch. Girls could come and watch it, and as well as the boys. And boys started to come to watch girls' basketball games. It was just a dynamic, athletic, environment.
Do you see an end to the war? And what role would the U.S. play in that?
I don't, unfortunately. I wish I'm known as a kind of incurably optimistic person. But I don't see this coming to an end now. If, for example, the Talibs were to gain control of the remaining parts of Afghanistan, controlled now by Ahmad Shah Massoud, I would still think that the war would continue on in some type of guerrilla form. I think it's also possible, if that happened, that within the Taliban movement there might become a splintering that would perhaps project continuing fighting there. I don't see anything really moving towards resolution right now. Everything that is being done by any influential international group is being done to promote the extension and the success of the war. The real input is being made by Pakistan and Saudi Arabia and to some degree Iran in Russia into providing weapons on, to either sides. And there's nothing really ongoing at this moment to promote the resolution of this war in a peaceful way, to promote any type of confidence building, which, you know, is so sorely needed now. The Afghans had a social fabric that, you know, was constructed over centuries. Those types of social fabrics in multi-ethnic nations are very, very fragile. That fabric has been ripped apart, and to reconstruct it, to tie it, sew it back together, is a monumental task that, you know, nobody has begun, and it will take decades and decades. And so my you know, read of this is not very optimistic, Barbara.
Thomas Gutierrez, thank you very much for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Nice to have been with you.
Thomas Gutierrez is the director of the Center for Afghanistan Studies at the University of Nebraska in Omaha. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.